The WEKU podcast of Eastern Standard with Cokie Roberts was recorded live at the 2017 Day Sponsor Reception and sponsored by the Gates Auto Family, serving Richmond and the surrounding region. GatesAutoFamily.com.
Every year in the spring, WEKU invites hundreds of our best friends, folks who donate to support the station, to join us for a reception featuring a special guest. Last year, that guest was NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. The year before, we talked politics with Don Gagne, and prior to that, former Morning Edition newscaster Gene Cochran. Also, each year, we record an Eastern Standard show with our guest, and this year, we're thrilled to bring you Cokie Roberts.
Most of the time when I'm on, I'm in my PJs because it's early in the morning and I'm at home and I have a nice microphone that looks like this at home. And so no, you don't have to be dressed at all. It's one of the best things about radio. But
now a political commentator for NPR and ABC News, Cokie is known as one of the founding mothers of NPR. It's time for Eastern Standard with Cokie Roberts in Lexington, right after the news from NPR. From WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University and the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. We are here for the annual WEKU Day Sponsor recognition, our fourth since starting the annual event in 2014. This year, our guest is Mary Martha Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs.
Roberts.
We know her as Cokie Roberts. And Cokie is, of course, a Morning Edition commentator at NPR. She previously served as a congressional correspondent for more than 10 years. In addition to her work for NPR, Cokie is a political commentator for ABC News, providing analysis for network news programming. From 1996 to 2002, she and Sam Donaldson co-anchored the weekly ABC interview program This Week. Cokie is the winner of numerous awards, the author of numerous books. She and her husband, Steve Roberts, write a weekly column syndicated in newspapers around the country. And we are pleased to welcome Cokie Roberts. Thank you for being with us, Cokie.
What a treat to be with you and all these gorgeous people.
We are grateful to have you with us, Cokie, and about 300 of our best friends from public
on
radio.
On a beautiful day here in Kentucky.
Absolutely. Well, Cokie, let's begin at the beginning. And, of course, you may have, I don't know if you know that during our fun drive a couple of months ago, we had a lot of fun talking about asking listeners if they could give your full name. And we had a lot of fun.
No, I didn't know about that. How close did they come?
We were talking about you. Your ears should have been burning. Most of them Googled it. Tell us about...
But you know, you can get false. You can get alternative facts on Google.
So we hear there, that in other places as well. But how did Mary Martha Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs Roberts become Cokie? Yeah.
So it's your basic Southern Catholic name. My grandmother's name was Corinne Morrison, and then she married a Claiborne, so she was Corinne Morrison Claiborne, and then my mother was Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs, and then I was Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs Roberts, but we had to have saints. So the saints are Martha and Mary, and so there you are. And my brother couldn't pronounce Corinne when I came home from the hospital and he was three, a mere 73 years ago. And so he christened me Cokie. And the fact is there's so many Corinnes in New Orleans that everybody has a nickname. Nobody's called Corinne. My mother's name was Corinne and she was called Lindy. So the name stuck.
We'll talk about Lindy Boggs and Hale Boggs as well. But I would like to talk about why and how you became interested in journalism and eventually public radio and beyond. Was it the political upbringing in your family that brought out the journalist in you?
No.
No? That was a yes and no question, which is a cardinal sin in broadcasting.
The fact is that we had kind of a... hate relationship with journalists as children, although my father and mother had met on the college paper. He was editor and she was women's editor at Tulane and she was at Newcomb. But and then he did work for newspapers in New Orleans to put himself through law school. But by the time we came along, we children, not my parents, but we children, pretty much hated the press, and because they could be mean. And so it was not anything I had ever planned to do. But my husband, who I met when I was 18 and he was 19, was always going to be a journalist, and it was his life's dream, and he did become a journalist and went immediately after we graduated from college, went to work for the New York Times. And so as I sort of traveled around the country and the world with him, it was easier to switch than fight. And so so I became a journalist.
Well, you are the daughter, as I mentioned, of two people whose names we recognize, Hale Boggs and Lindy Boggs, both of your parents served in the U.S. Congress. I don't know if there are many people who could make that claim. Let's talk about your father, the late House Majority Leader Hale Boggs, and the circumstances that brought your mother to Congress.
Well, my father was elected when he was 26 in 1940, and I think about this now because it's just so remarkable to me, since I do write books about women in history. My mother was 24 years old. She had two babies, neither of whom was me, and it was pre-World War II Washington, which was just like the Washington that I write about in Ladies of Liberty, which is the early republic. You had to go calling on people, and it was very formal, and protocol ruled everything. And fortunately, she was raised in New Orleans, so she knew from protocol. But it's really too bad you can't see my facial expressions on the radio.
There are probably dozens of cameras capturing them.
I feel like the transcript should read, "Mrs. Roberts rolled her eyes." You know? But at any rate, there they were, these kids. I mean, of course, in that era, you were much more of a grown-up at 24 and 26 than you are now. You were not expected to be on your parents' insurance. But she was living this very formal life, and she told the story the first day she had to go calling, the horn honks, and she runs down to the car to get in with the nice ladies who are gonna take her calling. And it was Lady Bird Johnson and Pauline Gore. And they were fast friends forevermore, along with, and Betty Ford joined the group and all of that. And I saw the tremendous power, really, and influence of these women who ran everything. They ran their political conventions, they ran their husbands' campaigns, of course they ran us kids. Along with the African American women in Washington, they ran all the social service organizations because it was before home rule and all of that in Washington. So it was a very important lesson to see growing up, to see how influential these women were. And so my father rose in Congress and then became, as you said, Majority Leader, and went to help a freshman congressman campaign in 1972 in Alaska, and the plane was lost and has never been found.
And to this day.
To this day. And so it was never any question in anyone's mind that my mother would run for the seat. She had been basically, particularly since he had gone into the leadership, she had been really running the district, and she had run all of his campaigns. So she ran for Congress in March of 73 and went into the House, where she was one of 16 women in the House of Representatives, and then served for 9 terms herself.
Let's talk about the history of NPR. As I have mentioned, you are known as one of the founding mothers.
Well,
of
I wasn't
NPR.
There at the very beginning. Linda Wertheimer and Susan Stamberg were there at the very beginning. And as Susan says, there weren't even any chairs. And they have very funny stories about the opening days. But Nina Totenberg came a couple of years later, and I came a couple of years after that.
How did you end up at NPR? What were you doing that caused you to get hired?
As I had said, we had moved around the country and the world, and Steve and I had been and our little bitty children had been in Athens, Greece. He had been the Times correspondent there, and I was a stringer for CBS News. and did a lot of radio for CBS. It was a very active time politically in that part of the world. And so I, although my first radio spot was CBS calling early one morning and saying that the Turks had invaded Cyprus. And my husband was in Cyprus. And I said, oh my God, Steve's there. And they thought I was bragging or something. And they said, well, we have a man there too, you know. Kind of not the point. But I had never written a radio spot before, but I went around, you know, threw the kids in the car and drove around the Pentagon. The Greek Pentagon was not far away, and checked out the action there and came back and wrote a spot, and then was on the radio hourly forevermore, and then on TV with it. And by the time Steve finally got out of Cyprus and got home, I was a seasoned correspondent. And so when we moved back to Washington, I wanted to work in radio.
And applied at NPR? Did someone contact you?
Well, I had never heard of NPR because it was new. And it really was, when we had left the country, it was very new. And so Steve went to his desk at the New York Times, and there was a woman sitting next to him whom he never met. And he said, who are you? And she said, my name is Judy Miller. And she had just left NPR. And he said, what is NPR? And she told him, and he said, that's the perfect place for my wife. And she said, well, call Nina Totenberg. So he called Nina, and Nina said, get her resume over here this afternoon. And the rest, as they say, is history, or herstory in this case, because it really was the women who made it happen.
NPR was a groundbreaking broadcaster in terms of the use of women in very prominent roles.
Well, but that's for two reasons. One is that it was new, so you didn't have to kill a man to put a woman in a job. You know. But so that made it easier. But also it didn't and still doesn't pay anything, and so you could get, as Frank Mankiewicz said, You can get more bang for the buck with the broads.
Different times, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, what was your first assignment? What did you begin doing when you were hired by NPR?
I began doing general assignment, as most new reporters do. And I was actually quite determined not to do politics in Congress because I had fought going home, and I felt like that was really going home. And so I did lots of lifestyle stories. I had young children, so I did a lot about education and things like that. But then it was the Panama Canal treaties, and we were the first radio live broadcast out of the Senate. And Linda Wertheimer was anchoring it, and they needed someone to do the stories for the broadcast. So they sent me up there, and here I still am.
This was the beginning of your role as a congressional reporter,
right,
and analyst. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We are at the WEKU 2017 Day Sponsor Recognition event at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington with Cokie Roberts, and we're going to return with more of Cokie Roberts, and we have an audience of maybe 300 people. It's certainly approaching 300 people, and we're going to ask them to step forward. They are the audience for this week's program. They are the callers. We're unable to take listener calls on this Thursday morning, but we're going to invite folks to come forward and perhaps participate in the Ask Cokie, something that's relatively new on NPR.
The other day at NPR, somebody said, I have a question for you. How many tablespoons are in a cup?
Well, we're going to ask Cokie in the next few minutes as Eastern Standard continues on the WEKU stations. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. This week with our special guest, Cokie Roberts, at the WEKU Day Sponsor event at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington, with a crowd of about 300 people present for the event. So thank you all for being here. We're really glad for your support. These are people who supported WEKU as day sponsors or who made a donation of more than $180 at some point during the past year. So we're very grateful for these folks who have helped to keep WEKU going and keep WEKU strong. I have a couple more questions for Cokie Roberts, and then we're going to turn to our audience. I'd like to ask Cokie about Ask Cokie, something that is happening on Morning Edition now, and it seems to be kind of wide-ranging in terms of, you mentioned the how many teaspoons in a cup.
Well, that was just in the hallway.
But how did Ask Cokie come about?
Well, because after the election, we were kind of groping around and saying, you know, I've been doing this Monday morning for a very long time, and they wanted to hear some new voices. This new voices thing, you know. But also, there was a real sense that that listener engagement is something that NPR wants to do more of, and we're hearing from our listeners that they want to be engaged, and so this was a way of getting listeners engaged and taking advantage of my historic knowledge. So I can, you know, I can answer questions from a broader perspective than others can, just because I've been around for a very long time. I did not cover the Washington administration. I just want to make that clear. But I have written about it at length, and so it was just a way to do something that mainly, the main reason for it was to engage listeners.
I mean, this occurred
after the election.
2016 election.
Right.
Is there a connection to that
election?
Well,
it was just, you know, what happens after elections is there always is a kind of, okay, now who goes where, who does what? That's a very common thing in every Washington newsroom.
Was it already on the drawing board before the election?
No. Are you kidding?
So there could be...
That would require forethought. And no, we thought it up as we went along.
We'll ask our listeners to come forward with a question for Cokie in just a few moments. Actually, in that process of the Ask Cokie segment...
Actually, my husband thought up the name, and he, of course, meant it as a joke, right? Why don't we ask Cokie? Ah!
It's better than Dear Abby. Cokie, do you get the questions for those segments in advance? Are you prepared for
those? So what we've been trying to do is to tee up questions that are on the news. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, this week it will be, and we send it out, you know, on all those social media platforms. So this week it's about presidents tangling with the FBI.
Hmm, imagine that.
Hmm. And then we try to have some historic tape in everyone, in addition to the listeners. But I like to get the listeners on tape themselves, because I like to hear the voices.
Let's do that right now at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington, Kentucky. We'll turn to our audience in attendance for the WEKU Day Sponsor reception. And our first speaker, please identify yourself and go right ahead with your question or comment for Cokie.
Hello, I'm Joyce Pfister Daly, and I'd like to know what you think of President Trump taking funding away from NPR.
Well, obviously, were he to do that, I would not think highly of it. But President Trump can't do that. The Congress appropriates money. The president does not. And fortunately, public broadcasting has many, many friends in Congress, because there are public radio stations in every district. And members of Congress understand the great value of it. But that doesn't mean that it's safe. It still means that people need to be in touch with their members of Congress, have to show their own appreciation for the station by doing events like this and showing your appreciation, because that also gets the attention of the members of Congress. If they see that their constituents care about the station, then that makes a difference in their calculation.
And Cokie, as one who's covered the goings-on of Congress, can you talk a little bit about that process? The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is funded through an allocation that is determined by the U.S. Congress. The president makes a recommendation in a budget proposal, but budget actually happens in the Senate, correct?
No, president's budgets. I remember one year with Jimmy Carter, his budget came out on Groundhog Day, and I remember writing a lead that said it's as likely to predict what's going to happen in the budget as the groundhog is, you know. A president's budget is a political statement of a president's priorities. It has really nothing to do with what is going to happen in terms of what how money gets spent. Now, the Congress theoretically does pass a budget, which the president does not sign. It is not does not go to a president. And it is supposed to set congressional priorities, and it is supposed to be a more definitive document. It has been years since Congress has been able to pass a budget. So the place that the decisions get made is at the appropriations committees of each house. And they sit there and say, this much money for Health and Human Services, which we come under, this much money for energy, this much, they just go through it item by item.
A lot of our listeners, and of course public broadcasting listeners and viewers across the country, are concerned. Do representatives and senators respond to the public when
Absolutely.
They make their will known?
Absolutely. The advocacy is incredibly important. Look, I can make a lot of complaints about this Congress, mainly that they are inactive by and large, but they are not insensitive in any way to their voters. In some ways, they're overly sensitive to their voters and too willing to do, sort of what the public mood is rather than lead and take some sense of responsibility for the nation as a whole. But they are very responsive to the people in their districts, absolutely.
Let's turn back to our audience here at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel, Resort, and Spa. I'm John Hingsbergen with Cokie Roberts.
Recognize Miss Lucier here.
You recognize
on her way to the ninth grade.
Please identify yourself.
In a big new school.
I'm Catherine, and I'm 14 years old, and I listen all the time.
Wonderful.
I was wondering, maybe not for a distinguished person like yourself, but when you're in radio, do you have to like dress up in a suit or whatever for every day at the
I'm in,
station?
Most of the time when I'm on, I'm in my PJs because it's early in the morning and I'm at home and I have a nice microphone that looks like this at home. And so no, you don't have to be dressed at all. It's one of the best things about radio. But
that's an excellent
now,
question.
There are hazards to doing it at home. The chief one in our house over the years has been dogs. And we had one dog who was a Basset Hound who loved being on the radio. He was a real radio hog. And he became so famous that all of the books about NPR that people have written over the years have more pictures of my Basset Hound than they do of me, of Linda, of Nina, Susan, the Basset Hound. And I was like, what did he ever do? I mean, but he had a quite remarkable howl. And he loved being on the radio so much that he would go down to the room underneath the room where we broadcast, because Steve also broadcasts out of there, and howl up. My current lab doesn't know all that.
Cokie, did you happen to see the video clip, the very popular on YouTube, of the BBC interview with the gentleman who was at home and the
children walked
into the room? Oh, it's fabulous.
Have I seen it? It was everywhere.
This is Eastern Standard, and we're talking with Cokie Roberts. Ask Cokie is what we're doing at the moment, and please identify yourself and go right ahead.
I know. This is Catherine's mother.
Yes. Hello. This is Carrie Lida Lucier, and I'm delighted to have you here. Could you please provide us some perspective on your impressions of this week's happenings in Washington and what we might think about them in the future, and if you're sleeping better at night now than perhaps in November 9th or 10th or 11th. Thanks.
Well, it's been a remarkable week. I was actually having coffee with Susan Stamberg, which we have never done before, and we had just decided, come on, we don't live that far apart, we haven't seen each other forever, let's have a cup of coffee. And suddenly my phone goes crazy, and it's get on the air right this second. This was ABC, and I said, why? The president just fired Jim Comey. We forgot to tell you that part. And And it has been kind of like that. I mean, that was the most dramatic, obviously, but we have had day after day of news or tweets that become news. And so it has been unsettling. I think that's true, both for the both for those of us in the business and for the country in a lot of ways. But you know, again, as a person who writes history and a person who's been around the institutions of government my entire life, I do feel, once again, admiring of the founders, because we do have this complicated system of checks and balances, which sometimes can drive you completely crazy, but other times you're very grateful for. And so I think that, you know, there's a real learning curve going on all over the place. I mean, we in the media are absolutely stepping up our game and trying to figure out how we deal with things that we haven't dealt with before. And the members of Congress are having trouble figuring out where their voters are in relationship to this president. And then the president is figuring out the presidency. And all of that is new and unsettling. And I do think that a lot of the country is kind of on edge at the moment. But it's, you know, it's something where we kept thinking, well, it'll settle down. But it hasn't settled down. And we'll see if it ever does.
From the perspective of history, has there been a time like this
at
all? No.
No.
You knew the question.
There have certainly been times that are partisan like this. That's certainly true. I mean, you know, people always say to me, is this the most partisan time ever? Is this the nastiest time ever? No, they're not shooting each other, which they used to do on a regular basis. And it wasn't just Burr or Hamilton. I mean, there was a dueling ground right outside of Washington in Bladensburg, where people would, and the term of art was, call each other out on the floor of the House of Representatives and go out and murder each other over what they said in the House. So that's better, it's improved. The metal detectors help. But seriously, it is a polarized partisan time, it certainly is. But we have never seen a presidency like this because we've never had a president who has never been held public office or been in the military. It's a new experience for him, and it's a new experience for the people dealing with him.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our guest, Koki Roberts, at the WEKU Day Sponsor event in Lexington, and our audience, supporters of WEKU, have gathered here, and they are the questioners, essentially the callers for the program. And sir, please identify yourself. Step on up to the microphone.
Charles. I met Charles earlier, too.
Yes.
What a memory.
My name is Charles Upton. I am an American Muslim. And I hope it would be appropriate at this time for me to ask one polite question of Donald Trump about his immigration policy, which would be, why is he trying to exclude all immigrants from 6 Muslim nations, hoping to weed out the terrorists, when, according to Judicial Watch, the FBI in 2015 had roughly 1,000 open cases on known ISIS terrorists loose within this nation? Why doesn't he pick these people off the street tomorrow? First things first, Mr. President, these are known terrorists. They should be behind bars. And if he doesn't deal with this, I don't believe him with his trying to protect us, excluding Muslims from 6 whole nations.
Well, his policy of trying to ban people coming from those 6 countries, of course, has been held up in the courts. It was heard again today in the Ninth Circuit. And again, this is the system of checks and balances that I was referring to. The courts have not allowed this to go forward. It has had, regardless of its implementation, it has had a very chilling effect on immigration in this country. And you talk to, I'm sure it's true here at Eastern Kentucky, you talk to any university, you talk to any medical institution, they are really suffering from the fact that people are afraid to come to this country from all over the world, from Western Europe, they're afraid to come to this country. And it is really having a very detrimental effect on lots of institutions, not to mention the agricultural sector. So it is a policy that, despite the fact that it has not been able to be enacted, is essentially working in the way that the president wants it to work, but not necessarily in a way that's working for a lot of American institutions.
How do you feel, Koki, about the reaction of a lot of people and organizations in this country to the Trump presidency and the directions of this administration? I mean, the day after the inauguration was the Women's March on Washington, and it occurred, of course, in many places around the country, and I understand
and
overseas as well. And it seems like there's been a march every weekend since.
Yes, the joke in Washington among women is marching is the new brunch. But
where are we marching today?
But I think there's activism on both sides, and I'm actually very excited about that. I think that having an engaged and interested citizenry is an essential part of an active democratic republic, and I'm very excited to see how many people are really getting involved and talking about running for office and maybe actually running for office. And I saw Laura here earlier tonight who told me she ran for the city council because she got engaged and she's now on the city council, and that's wonderful. And so I think that there has been kind of a reaction on both sides through the campaign. There was a very similar kind of outpouring for Donald Trump, and it's certainly still true at all of his rallies, where there are lots of very excited, enthusiastic people for the president. So it's working both ways.
What do you think that these demonstrations and these activist activities actually accomplish? Do they do anything, or are they just making people feel good?
Well, it depends. It depends on what they then do with it. If what they do is organize and vote, first of all, I mean, I think a lot of people who showed up at the Women's March hadn't voted and admitted they hadn't voted. But also, as I said earlier, members of Congress do respond to their constituents. And I think that they're probably not thrilled to have people yelling at them at town hall meetings, and it's really unnecessary to be so impolite and uncivil. But I think to show up and show your opinion is very important.
We're going to turn back to our audience in just a few moments. We are at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington. It's the annual WEKU Day Sponsor reception and event. And our guest this year, Koki Roberts, who is a political commentator for NPR, ABC, author of best-selling books. We should talk a little bit about some of your books and some of your other activities in the final segment of our program. And we have our audience of approaching 300 people at the Griffin Gate Marriott. And we'll return to our audience who are callers for this week's program on Eastern Standard after we take a short break. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsberg, and pleased to be here with Koki Roberts at the WEKU Day Sponsor event in Lexington at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel, Resort, and Spa, and an audience of about 300 people in attendance, people who have supported WEKU with their donations. We are grateful for your support, and Koki Roberts, we're grateful for you being available to join us for this event.
It's wonderful to be here.
Let me ask you, you were once a reporter, and really primarily practicing the craft that we would call objective journalism, I guess. Now you're a commentator. What is the difference?
I'm old.
That's kind of like senior correspondent,
right,
at NPR.
I mean, I can't run around the halls of the Capitol. The most marble floors were getting to me. But no, seriously, you know, you get to a stage where you've covered the budget pretty much every year for 20 years, and it's time for someone else to cover the budget, and for you to step back and put things much more in context and perspective.
How do you feel about how NPR and public radio have developed over these 40 years?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Or so?
I mean, I
Could you have ever imagined what it has become, the 26 or so million people who listen to public radio now?
26 million a week, exactly. Well, I could imagine, actually, because what was true really from the very beginning was that more people were listening than were reading, like at the time, Time Magazine, which was the most popular magazine, you know, news magazine in America. You forget, you know, all of these institutions. So from the time that NPR really became a national network, it had more listeners than the New York Times had readers, all of that. Part of that is the medium, but it certainly has become the first place for news for millions and millions of Americans, and that is a wonderful thing. Morning Edition and All Things Considered are listened to. Morning Edition is listened to by more people than view the three morning network programs combined. Yes. So, and actually quite a few more. Now that's a little bit apples to oranges because they're measured differently, but then you look apples to apples, which is what they call the weekly cum. And that at, I just checked it today before coming here, at Morning Edition it's 14.7 million people a week. All Things Considered it's 14.4 million people a week. Now, it used to be that they were just behind Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh. Sean Hannity is now at 13 million, so they're ahead of them. Now, what I don't know is what Rush's numbers are because I can't get them from anybody but Rush. And he says it's 26 million people. Now, if that's true, he's had a jump of his listenership has doubled in the last year, and that might be true. So that tells you something about where we are.
Well, Cokie Roberts, last year during the run-up to the 2016 election, you co-wrote a syndicated newspaper column calling for the rational wing of the Republican Party to stop Donald Trump's march toward its presidential nomination. Tell us about that and its eventual resolution and what the little bit of a firestorm that set off.
It was a very tiny firestorm. My husband and I write a weekly column together, which we have for many, many years, and said many things in it, but this one evoked some response. And the truth is that it was hardly unusual for people to be calling on the Republican leaders to be stopping Donald Trump. Mainly other Republicans were calling on Republican leaders to do that. But they couldn't figure out how to do it. They really couldn't. And they all kept kind of thrashing around trying to figure it out, and they never quite got there. Now, part of the problem was that by the end, the only person they could see that could stop Trump was Ted Cruz, and they couldn't stand him. And I mean, really, the Republican leaders in the Senate just couldn't stand him. And so they kind of threw up their hands, and there they were.
I suspect there are some in this room who were surprised at the election of Donald Trump, and I have heard that you were not surprised.
Right.
When did you first think that Donald Trump would be elected president?
Pretty early. I knew he'd get the nomination, and I knew he'd win for president. And everybody thought that I had lost it. You know, oh poor thing, you know. She's you know, doesn't know anymore what's going on. And it was for several reasons, but part of it was history. History certainly pointed to not electing a president of the same party for a third term. But there was such a mood of change and of a desire for change and of the kind of change that just basically said, throw everything up in the air and see where it lands. It can't be worse than this. And even though you can look at the macro numbers and say, actually, this isn't so bad, for individuals in certain circumstances, it feels bad. And I really did understand that. And I could see it happening. And some of it is because I grew up in the South and I recognized a lot of it. But I just could see that change was what people were after. And when I looked on election night at the exit polls, we asked the question, you know, what are the characteristics that you think are most important? And there's, you know, experience, shares your values, you know, there's things like that. And one was brings change. And it won by, you know, 2-1. I mean, so 40-some percent of the people said brings change, whereas for all the others, it was about 20-some percent of the people. And then of those 40-some who said brings change, more than 80% of those people voted for Trump. So it was a change election, and I could see it. It was just clear in the electorate.
One more question before I turn back to our audience. The Electoral College. What is your opinion of the Electoral
Electoral College.
Okay. And there are those who are questioning its...
I'm well aware.
Continued,
my father actually introduced a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. And he was very active in an attempt to get rid of the Electoral College. Forgive me, Father, but I think you were wrong. I think that if you didn't have the Electoral College, what we'd have is a national election that would be played out in the media and would be all about money, and that individual states would never be heard, and that the country would never be represented in all of its oddities and diversities. And also, if you didn't have a state-by-state election, you would really end up with minorities not being heard, because even though you have black voters, for instance, are about 10 to 12% of the population, that's not going to get you very far in a national election unless it's terribly close. But in Georgia, in New York, in Illinois, it makes a big difference. And same thing with the Hispanic vote. You know, you look at it in Nevada and, you know, in California, obviously. I mean, you go state by state and see what the votes are. And you can see, and we're talking a lot about this now, as the demography changes, the votes starts to tip. I mean, the Georgia election we're looking at right now, I think the Republicans likely to win that special election, but it wouldn't even be a question if the demography hadn't changed. And so what you have is the reflection of the country changing and minority groups having a larger voice when it's a state-by-state election.
So we're at the Griffin Gate Marriott with our WEKU Day sponsors, or those who've donated at the day sponsor level, with Cokie Roberts.
Hi, I'm Karen Summers. I want to ask about objective news coverage in this political time. You know, I think reporters pride themselves on giving equal and fair time to different candidates, but how do you handle it when maybe one candidate is, you know, quote-unquote alternative facts or trying to distract from maybe the real story? And, you know, I think sometimes we think of fair and balanced being the same amount of time when different issues may have more importance.
Well, it's hard to, you know, sometimes sorting that kind of thing out can be very difficult. I remember at one point when Congress was debating sanctions against South Africa, against the apartheid government. This is years ago now, right? And basically, the vote was 400 and some to a handful in the House of Representatives. But you put on the air sort of 2 minutes on the pro side, 2 minutes on the anti side. Is that fair? I don't know. You know, it's kind of, when you're covering a debate like that, what you do. But it in some ways distorts where the actual sentiment was. In an attempt to be very fair, sometimes you can distort unintentionally. I do think that in this current environment where, you know, there's an attack on the media, and there's all this talk about fake news and alternative facts and all that stuff, I do think everybody stepped up their game. I think there's been a very conscious exercise of responsibility on the part of lots of news organizations of saying, you know, we can't just put this on the air or in the paper. We have to say this isn't true, or, you know, contrary to the facts or something like that, because otherwise you're not really giving the whole story. But it's been complicated because it isn't what we normally do.
Back to our audience.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Pitts, and I'm a reporter here in Kentucky, so my question is also about the media.
What advice would you give reporters and journalists in this day and age in order to provide the best coverage?
Well, I mean, basically do it. But, you know, the hardest thing is having the resources to do it. And that's where we've really had to pay attention to the changing world of journalism has been in the area of resources, which again is why you all are so important and why NPR is so important, because in an age when major news organizations are shutting down foreign bureaus and domestic bureaus all over, NPR is opening them. And it's never been a time when it's more important to do that. I mean, what happens in Syntagma Square in Athens can affect your 401k. And to shut yourself down from the foreign news reporting, foreign news gathering, which is incredibly expensive, is to shut off your readers, viewers, listeners from very important information for their lives. But that's why you guys are so important, because that is why the only way we can do it is with you. And that's how America gets the best news there is. It's because of people like you showing up at something like this and writing your checks. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks to all of you for your support. And next in line is among our supporters here this evening.
I'm Stephanie Adams, and I teach social work at EKU. And I teach policy history. And one of the things we talk about, you touched on briefly, was the cycles of history. So can you talk a little bit about just what you've seen over the time about kind of those more liberal cycles and more conservative cycles?
Well, that's a much longer conversation than we have in 3 minutes and 33 seconds. But I don't think we can yet predict if we are heading into a different cycle yet. I think we're kind of in a moment of disruption. And that we sort of have to see how it shakes down. And I think some of it will be revealed in the off-year elections, particularly at the gubernatorial level. But I'm not sure that we can say that we're moving through a cycle at this moment.
Julie McCosco, Kerber. And I just want to say bravo, WEKU, for everything you're doing for Kentucky, and bravissimo to you for coming be with us.
Thank you.
Great. If you would just share, maybe, I don't know, on a personal basis, what it meant for you to have Hillary Rodham Clinton run, and what that means to your daughter, to our daughters of the future.
Well, I do write about women in history, and I certainly would like to see a woman president before I die. And I think it did mean a great deal to see a woman in that position. It didn't mean as much, apparently, to younger women as it did to older women, and I get that. Because there is, a sense that everything is possible when you're young. I must say that my reaction is kind of, just you wait, my pretty. but I totally understand it, and I do see the difference. I think that she did break barriers that will make it easier for the next woman coming along, and that is, that's very hard for her. Because it's the barrier she certainly thought she was going to achieve the final goal. She today announced that she is starting a new organization encouraging women to run. And I think that that is a very wise thing for her to think about. So.
Randy Hall, what is your mother's favorite recollection of Lady Bird Johnson?
Well, my mother is no longer with us, I'm sorry to say, but she had many, many. The two of them were very, very close friends. But I will tell you quickly that when my mother ran for Congress, she called Mrs. Johnson to say that she was running so Mrs. Johnson wouldn't read in the paper. And she said, well, Lindy, I think that's a wonderful idea, but how are you going to do it without a wife?
Political reality, huh? Excellent. And one final question from our audience.
Courtney Spear. I I have watched you over the years and so much appreciated your efforts at giving us the whole picture and being professional about it.
Thank you.
And my question is, how do you maintain composure and professionalism in facing some of our issues and the personalities that you cover?
Thank you, Courtney.
Well brought up.
Obviously.
The combination of my parents and the nuns, it worked.
Koki, I think an important final question for our conversation would be for you to talk about the future of public radio, the future of journalism, its role in this democracy, in this world where there are so many challenges. Tell us how you view that future. Are you hopeful? Why? Actually, I believe you are. I am hopeful.
I am basically a Pollyanna, and I believe in this country deeply. And I think that we come out right in the end, usually. But in order to get to that place, we do need to know what's going on. And in an increasingly complex world, we need more and more and more information. And that really is why National Public Radio and all of our stations are so important. It's why I'm here, because I think it's incredibly important to support our stations because of the work that all of you do. And of course, we wouldn't exist without you. And we need the information that you bring us. And so I think that that it is essential to the workings of a well-informed electorate to have this unique and incredibly useful medium. But it has also become the most important news outlet for millions and millions and millions of Americans. And that's good news, but it also means that we have to keep supporting it.
Koki Roberts, thank you for everything you do today, thank you for what you've meant to millions as one of the founding mothers of public radio.
Thank you all so very, very much for being here.
Thank you for being here. Thank you to the WEKU listeners at the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception, giving Koki Roberts a standing ovation. Thank you so much. Thanks to our student producers, Marissa Hempel, Devonna Gaines, Zach Redding, and Julia Dake. Thanks to Jim Whitaker for running the sound for us this evening. Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. It's available as a podcast and is repeated on Sunday evening at 6. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.
The WEKU podcast of Eastern Standard with Koki Roberts was recorded live at the 2017 Day Sponsor Reception and sponsored by the Gates Auto Family, serving Richmond and the surrounding region. GatesAutoFamily.com.